KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.
To Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg today, your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I am here with Pat Schlarbaum.
Yeah, good to be here, Ursula.
Last night we had, or yesterday afternoon, we had a party here at KHOI as part of the fun drive.
What a turnout.
Wall-to-wall people.
Yeah.
I think we need to buy a new building.
Well, or expansion?
a bigger building,
a
not
deck.
A new building.
Maybe we need a deck in the alley, maybe. But it was to honor Janet Kloss.
And Paul Nelson.
And all their contributions here at the station. Man, it just touched my heart.
It was very beautiful. Very beautiful to have everybody there. And Paul was here, which was really great.
Oh, yeah.
To have him here.
And Irv Kloss.
Irv Kloss
was representing the Kloss family. Oh,
that's
man.
Right. And we had some of our KHOI hosts talk about new shows and that they're producing at KHOI. And we also made an exciting announcement. KHOI is forming a partnership with the Iowa State Daily to create a audio production workshop or program that will teach people audio editing and podcast creation.
Yeah, what a fantastic development with a university here in town and having students be exposed to where everything happens here and to rub shoulders with Ursula Rudenberg and Cynthia McClure. Doesn't get any better than that. I mean, you know, educationally.
Well, we're just excited to be connecting more to, the campus town side of Ames. And be forward to see what will happen. So we'll be doing some workshops this spring semester with Iowa State students.
And Tom Richards.
Tom Richards performed.
Music, wow. What
and
a
he
legacy.
Brought it. Yeah. He brought it. He played all night long, and it was absolutely gorgeous. And the food was fantastic, too. So we had a great party yesterday.
Yeah.
We really did.
It was touching.
Yeah. And it's all part of the fun drive that we're having. And so just remind you, if you have not taken out your membership yet, KHOI is member supported. And we're asking you to take out a membership to KHOI so we can keep this ship afloat.
Oh, my gosh.
And the easiest way to do it is to go to khoifm.org and donate at the website.
$55 for an annual membership, but as much as you feel comfortable with being able to budget, but a friends group of $250 annually, now that's the commitment that shows that you really want to invest in the future of community radio here in Ames. So
yeah.
Their opportunities are there, and what a threshold, 5 years and
five
growing
years. That's
and still
right.
developing. It's just fantastic what the staff and board are providing. The citizens
and
of
all the volunteers too.
Yeah.
Well, today it's sunny, breezy, and pleasant with highest temperatures around 57 degrees. Sun and clear skies are pretty much predicted all of the days and nights of this week, with temperatures dropping dramatically earlier this week. Tuesday night may get down to 18 degrees, and Wednesday should be around 28 degrees Wednesday night. Tomorrow should be dropped down to about 37 degrees during the day. But Thursday, Thanksgiving, temperatures should go up again to about 46, and Friday should be in the 50s. Temperatures will drop towards the weekend again, though with highs on Sunday in the mid-30s. Climate researchers funded by the National Science Foundation are telling us to expect a frigid winter with at least one visit from a lobe of the polar vortex. The polar vortex is a massive area of cold air high up in the atmosphere that normally hovers above the poles. Many of us remember the polar vortex of 2013, I think. Quite memorable. The combination of wet and cold could result in above-normal snow season in parts of northern U.S. I was expected to feel a lot of this, although the main areas will be hit around the Great Lakes area.
And a summary of some of Iowa news from last week is brought to you by the Iowa Informer, A new director has been selected to lead Iowa's $5 billion Medicaid program. Iowa's program has been plagued with problems, including patients losing or receiving reduced coverage and insurers leaving the state after former Governor Terry Branstad privatized the system. The newly appointed director is the former director of Kansas' controversial Medicaid program, Michael Randall. Randall directed a similarly troubled privatized program in his state called CanCare. He departed that program last month before a delayed rollout of revisions to the $3.2 billion plan that serves 425,000 Kansans. Finn Bullers, a graduate of Iowa State University journalism program and Kansas reporter who was an outspoken critic of the privatized program in Kansas, on which he relied on for his survival, Bullers fought to maintain Medicaid coverage and once accused Kansas Governor Brownback of painting a bullseye on my back, claiming he was cheated and trying to scam the system, a poster boy, if you will, for Medicaid fraud and abuse in Kansas. But my only motive was to continue to breathe. Bullers died last year at 52 after suffering from a disabling case of muscular dystrophy. A prominent Iowa Republican named Jamie Johnson has resigned as the head of the Department of Homeland Security's Center for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. The Department of Homeland Security's Center for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships was created in 2006 by executive order to help emergency managers effectively engage with a broader cross-section of faith and community-based organizations in all stages of the disaster sequence. In response to problems discovered with hurricanes Katrina, Wilma, and Rita, Johnson is an ordained minister and former talk radio host. He had introduced Donald Trump at an August 2016 campaign rally in Des Moines, where he prayed that God grant Trump the wisdom of the biblical figure King Solomon, who, by the way, was led astray from God because of his obscene wealth and 1,000 wives and concubines. Johnson resigned following a report from CNN's K-File about disparaging remarks he made in the past about African Americans and Muslims. He blamed the black community for creating city slums and said that Islam was good for nothing except for, quote, oil and dead bodies, unquote. Republicans in the Iowa Senate have said their internal investigation into sexual harassment among members of their caucus office has been completed, but they will not release the final report to the public. The investigation was carried out as the result of a lawsuit filed by former communications director Kirsten Anderson. Anderson's alleged there was a boys' club culture of sexual harassment in the office, and she received a $1.75 million settlement. Senate Republicans previously announced the creation of a new HR position under their oversight to address future complaints. However, they refused to allow an independent investigation into her allegations and are continuing to claim that Anderson was fired not in retaliation for filing a harassment complaint, but instead because of poor work performance, although the Polk County jury decided unanimously to the contrary. And those are a few of the stories of Iowa in the news, brought to you by the Iowa Informer, and you can find more stories at iowainformer.com. And also, troubling news here at Ames in our own front yard, a man was murdered in Ames Saturday morning, and police say the suspects in the case are still at large. What began as a robbery just after 3:30 a.m. at the Fountain View apartment complex across the street from the Ames Middle School, it turned deadly. Neighbors woke up to the shock of the city's first homicide this year. I believe this is located between South Dakota and State Avenue here in southwest Ames. For all accounts, the area is a safe place to live. So that's a troubling report from here in Ames, but also some other developing aspects, hopefully not so troublesome, but maybe we can start to address some of our quality of Iowa's waters is still a major concern. The issue is coming into focus in northeastern Iowa, where a meeting will be held on November 29th in Elkader, Iowa, concerning a 10,000-head cattle feedlot scheduled to be built in the watershed of Bloody Run Creek, which is a cold water trout stream north of Dubuque.
Larry Stone, a name that many of the listeners may found familiar, more in the printed word, but it's great to have you with us here, Larry. So could you tell us a little bit about your career and the books that you have authored?
Well, I spent 25 years as outdoor writer, photographer with the Des Moines Register. That was from 1972 to 1997. And writing about anything outdoor, conservation, nature related, I guess, during that time. When I left the Register, I put together a book of my columns, which we called Listen to the Land, some of my favorite columns. Then after that, I did a couple of books, one on Sylvan Runkle, Citizen of the Natural World. My co-author was John Stravers, a good friend of both Pat and mine, kind of a raptor aficionado and a good friend of Sylvan. Then John and I also did another book called Gladys Black, The Legacy of Iowa's Bird Lady. John actually got started bird watching because of Gladys, and I'd known Gladys as a reporter with the Des Moines Register for years, so that worked out real well.
And your home is Elkader, Iowa?
Yeah, I live in Clayton County, actually southeast of Elkader along the Turkey River. We've been there since 1992. We've lived in Clayton County actually since 1974. I actually grew up in Warren County, south central Iowa. I was on the farm, Iowa quail and pheasant country, so spent a lot of time as a kid out hunting and fishing and playing in the creeks and the pastures in that part of the state.
So. And your outdoor experiences and passion is carried so well, and it kind of brings to mind the topic today, Clayton County. They're noted for its trout streams. And cold water opportunities for people to go out and experience nature in some of the most sublime and beautiful areas to the planet. And Bloody Run is an area that I might share with the listeners that in a previous life I was running trains for the Chicago Northwestern and was back and forth between Clinton and Blair, Nebraska, and realized in the early 80s that I kind of wanted to have a place in northeast Iowa that I could call home and kind of refer to in my mind, and went to Clayton County and ended up at a beautiful county park called Bloody Run. And Larry, you're also in your esteemed career as one of the conservation board members of Clayton County. And now we've got the situation where a large confinement animal feeding operation, a CAFO, is scheduled to be constructed in the watershed of Bloody Run.
And technically, it's not actually a CAFO, and that this is interesting the way the animal feeding operation rules of the state are set up. It's going to be, quote-unquote, open feedlots, 10,000 head of cattle at a time, in buildings that have 10% of them are unroofed. In other words, if that meets the requirement of an open feedlot, if you have 10% of the floor space has sky above it, then it's an open feedlot, not a CAFO or confinement. They want to leave it open because the rules for open feedlots are less strict than the rules for confinement operations. Confinements more typically are hog and swine operations. A lot of cattle operations are open feedlots, and so they do have a little bit of sky that they can see from their pens. But the interesting thing about this operation, got to commend the developers. It's Walls Energy is the name of the operation. They are trying to innovate, looking for the cutting edge way of the future to handle animal waste. Their idea is to take the manure from 10,000 head of cattle, run it through a digester, and produce eventually biogas. As manure decomposes anaerobically, and that's their approach, it produces a number of things: methane, hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, and a number of other, you might call them toxins, just because of the anaerobic digestion of the chemical process. Their hope is to take those decomposing products, scrub them, clean them, and produce saleable natural gas. That's the hope of the Walls Energy operation. Some of us, as I said, commend them for looking ways to better handle animal manure, but 10,000 head of cattle in the watershed of Bloody Run Creek in an area of northeast Iowa that is known for sinkholes and karst or fractured bedrock down through which water can seep, it just doesn't seem to be the place for this kind of an experiment.
And a sinkhole is on the surface of the farmland, basically a cavern or a hole that pollutants or toxins can enter the groundwater.
Yes, and the sinkholes, in this part of the state, there are hundreds, thousands of them on this particular piece of property. I think there are six and that are designated on a DNR sinkhole map. The problem with sinkholes is that they can open up spontaneously in an area where there is this fractured limestone that is, you know, limestone is soluble in water over thousands of years, and it gradually will erode away. And then what might have been a flat field one day, the next day will have a hole in the ground where a sinkhole has collapsed and opened up with a pathway into the groundwater.
Well, on October 11th, DNR inspectors visited the site near Monona in Clayton County and determined that sediment had washed into the Bloody Run Creek from the Walls Energy Project. So it sounds like construction is moving forward.
That's, a long and interesting story. Construction apparently started sometime last spring, February, March, April, May, in that time frame. Supposedly, if you're doing that kind of a construction project, you need what is called a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, NPDES permit. There's a bit of discussion among the lawyers as if you have to have that permit before you start, or if you only need the permit if you should happen to have a problem. Apparently, Walls moved ahead with the concurrence of the DNR saying, okay, if there's not a problem, we're not going to do any enforcement. In June, the DNR issued what they call a notice of violation to saying, hey, Walls, you're having a problem. Again, in October, as you said, Pat, they issued another notice of violation saying, you're having a problem. So they are now being required to get a permit. There will be discussion, ongoing discussion about that, and a public hearing on that November 29th in Elkader at the county office building from 4 to 6 p.m. So we'll see where that discussion goes.
So November 29th, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. In the Clayton County office building, 600 Gunder Road in Elkader. I think it's appropriate to point out that there, and you mentioned the Master Matrix. Now, these are a program that the Department of Natural Resources has constructed to follow through in a competent manner to provide these entities some approval of their business model. If there's ever an area that I would suggest that local control may have a strengthening hand above this master matrix model. So what is the intent of the public meeting November 29th?
It's essentially to receive comments on the application that Walls has made to have a stormwater construction NPDES permit. The irony of that is, in theory, one would think that that permit is required before you actually start construction. The construction has been going on and is maybe nearing completion for most of this year. The DNR, when some of us asked last summer that they have a public hearing, they said, we don't want to delay the process of issuing the permit any longer. We need a permit in place, so if we have a public hearing, it'll have to be a 30-day notice, and then the permit delay would take long, or the permit would take longer to issue. We protested that. They finally relented and agreed to not issue the permit, to go ahead and wait and have a public hearing with the notice. It will be November 29th. Construction, meanwhile, is continuing apace. So what purpose the permit will serve if it is issued? Good question. What will happen if the permit is not issued is another good question that the lawyers may have to fight over. So it's there's six large buildings that are almost roofed, 10% open feedlots that are pretty much constructed right now. There's a huge, several-acre wastewater lagoon, which didn't need a permit, the DNR tells us, because they elected to call it a wastewater lagoon as opposed to a livestock waste lagoon, because the livestock waste will go into the methane digester, then the effluent from the methane digester will go into the wastewater lagoon. It seems to me there's some fuzzy language there, some loopholes that maybe make the oversight not as strict as it otherwise could be.
Is that retention pond, is there lining, or what's the assurance that it won't leak?
That's a very good question, Pat. The permit says that it must have a 2 feet clay liner in the bottom. And it also, there's a phrase that says if it's within a certain distance, it might be, I don't remember the exact number of feet, but if it's too close to the bedrock, then it also needs a synthetic liner. How they determine how close it is to the bedrock and whether that synthetic liner is actually needed is another question. I guess we're a little bit worried that in the process of building the wastewater basin lagoon, if they get down too low and dig into the bedrock and open up a sinkhole, then you have an immediate problem that may be hard to rectify.
Yeah, these environmental challenges always seem to be multiplying. What are your thoughts on local control of these operations?
Ideally, local people should have some more say over what is happening there. You mentioned the master matrix and the possibility of local control. The interesting thing about the master matrix, the legislature devised that in 2002. It's gone for 15 years without any changes. In retrospect, I think some of the livestock producers, as well as people concerned about the environment, might say that there are some loopholes in that master matrix. Essentially, it's just a scoring system, whereas people wanting to produce or wanting to construct, particularly referring to CAFOs or confinement operations, need to meet certain criteria as far as distance from neighbors and that sort of thing. There's a movement afoot among a number of counties, about a dozen or more counties, asking boards of supervisors, asking the legislature and the governor to reopen the master matrix and see what new restrictions there need to be. What the chances are of that coming up in the legislature, again, I'm not sure. You mentioned local control. Local control, in theory, sounds like a good idea. But animal feeding operations and CAFOs in particular can be so controversial that I think in some cases local boards of supervisors would prefer to pass the buck on to the DNR and say, well, you've met the weak master matrix criteria. There's nothing we can do to prevent this operation. Heaven forbid I might step on my neighbor's toes. So therefore, it's now in the hands of the DNR, and if it goes, boards of supervisors pass it on to the DNR. The DNR routinely will approve it, and that just means one more CAFO in Iowa, and there are a number, I forget the number, over 5,000 right now. We have in Iowa about 23 million hogs in the state at a time. the 6 months turnaround on the hog operation. So does that mean, I think, 60-some million hogs that are raised in Iowa annually? Multiply the manure a hog produces by 5, roughly, to get the equivalent number of people. So Iowa has 300 million. the sewage from of 300 million people spread on our land each year.
Here in Iowa, maybe 3 million people.
There's 3 million people now, but the equivalent to 60 million hogs would be, you know, pick a number, 200 million people.
Oh, I see, 300. Yeah. Equivalent to 300
equivalent
million.
Equivalent to that many, yeah.
Is there anything else we've overlooked here, Larry? Thank you for your comprehensive periscope perspective on something happening essentially in your front yard.
Well, and again, I want to commend the producers that are looking for ways to reduce the impacts of this livestock waste and livestock on the Iowa landscape. I eat beef, I eat pork, and I'm, you know... So from that standpoint, maybe I'm a little bit guilty, too, in causing this amount of livestock to be raised in Iowa. I grew up on a farm. I raised cattle and hogs as a kid. But I think we need to look awfully hard at the way the livestock are being raised now and what the potential is, at least, for some of the major impacts on our waters and our land and our air. Air quality, especially in Iowa.
Well, Larry Stone, as the citizen of the natural world that you carry so well, I think your time here is well spent, and we can let the people know, maybe play it on carpooling up. It's November 29th, Clayton County Office Building, 600 Gunder Road in Alcater, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. If you want to learn more about the 10,000-head livestock feeding operation in the watershed of a pretty major trout stream in northeast Iowa, Bloody Run Creek.
Thank you, Pat. I'm glad I could be on and enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Larry Stone.
Peter Mayer with Blue Boat Home. So if you just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I am Pat Schlarbaum, hosting today with Ursula Rudenberg. And I do want to mention that this evening in Cedar Rapids, there will be a follow-up to the Iowa Cold Water Conservancy gathering that Larry Stone is involved with. It's this evening, November 20th, 6 p.m. at the Cedar Rapids Library in Whipple Auditorium, and that's at 450 Fifth Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. So I'll be heading over there to do some recording. I'm going to be leaving
about... Will
you
take some people with you?
Yeah, let's carpool. You know, get a hold of me here at the station.
Sounds good.
But we need to cover this. This is a very valuable gatherings, mm-hmm. and there are senators that are going to be in the audience, so we need to get this issue of water conservancy addressed here in the state of Iowa.
And you're going to bring back a report.
And we'll have a report later. I know there's some it's pretty complicated when you start entering in with the master matrix and all these different entities that are controlling our water quality. But we got to figure this stuff out, folks. It's time to be a bit more diligent in cleaning up our water as opposed to being an area that just sends a lot of pollutants down to the Gulf of Mexico.
Earlier this month, Local Talk reporter Kay Puttock interviewed Patricia Izbicki, a graduate student in neuroscience at Iowa State University, about Patricia's fascinating research on the effects of music on the human brain and the nervous system. Since then, the Technology Association of Iowa has recognized Patricia as an Iowa Woman of Innovation. Patricia is one of 10 women awarded this distinction. Her research has significant implications for how music therapy can be applied to different diseases and conditions and for many other important areas. Here is some of what they talked about when Patricia Izbicki sat down to explain to Kay Patak what she does. Patricia's major professor at Iowa State was with them, Dr. Elizabeth Stegemoller, whom Patricia calls Dr. S, and she was part of the conversation as well.
I am actually studying or getting my PhD in neuroscience. So I have a music performance background, not a music therapy background, but music therapy and then also music and medicine have always interested me because I've seen the effects on even people who don't have any kind of neuropsychiatric or neurologic disorders. And so Dr. S and I met and the rest is history.
So could you say a bit more about that, the effects of music on people that don't have any neurological complaints?
I'm mainly interested in how music training impacts different individuals, specifically adults. And so my research will mainly be focused on that. So I can talk a little bit about how just music lessons and music training can
impact. Ahead.
Mainly, if you think about when you're playing an instrument, you have the piece of music in front of you. So you're not only using the visual areas of your brain, you're moving. So you're using the motor cortex, just like when you're listening to music, that area is activated, right? Either you're playing a piano or you're singing or you're playing some other instrument. And then you have your frontal regions, which are really working with things like, first of all, inhibition, so not getting distracted, and working memory, so remembering what you just played in order to keep on playing. And you also have, very importantly, your temporal lobes or your auditory cortex, so that responsible for actually hearing the music and processing. So you're getting a full brain workout when you're playing any sort of instrument. And so because of that, we've seen so many different, you know, enhancements in those in musicians versus non-musicians. And I can go in a little bit into that. So you see not only structural enhancements. So when you think about when you're learning a skill, so let's say you're learning to play a piece of music. In your brain, you have these cells called neurons, and you have so many of them. They're around between 60 to 100 billion. We're not going to argue about that today, but there's just so many. That's mainly the point to get across. And every time you're learning a skill, these cells kind of branch out to each other and connect with other cells that are or other neurons that are used in that skill. And so
the connections. Improve.
Yes, the connections.
The synapses, I believe.
Yes, the synapses, exactly. And so the more and more you practice that piece, the more and more synapses you're going to get. And those actually, they're actually going to change the structure in brain. So you're going to have more gray matter, so to speak. So just a little bit more brain. And you see that in actual studies where you use something called structural magnetic resonance imaging or just MRI. Most everyone is kind of familiar with that one. And so you see that. But so that's already interesting in itself that there's some kind of, you know, neuroplasticity going on, so to speak. But then you have, do those have any kinds of effects on what we do every day or any enhancements? And so we see not only enhancements in speech processing. So for example, musicians are generally better able to hear in noise. So like if you're at a cocktail party, right, there's a lot of things going on and you want to be able to listen to your partner that you're talking with. And so musicians generally are better able to do that.
So they're better tuning out the distractions.
Exactly.
And concentrating.
So they have better memory, working memory, right, because you have to remember. What's really interesting, in terms of children, several studies have shown that music training is even associated with accelerated brain maturation. So we don't have any proof, okay, that's what's really causing these enhancements in
but
kids.
But there's a correlation there.
Yeah.
Not
so
necessarily a causation.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's something might be there for that.
Could I just ask a bit more about tuning out distractions? That made me think of people with, or kids with ADHD. Has any been any work done with that?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. My research is really involving inhibition, so the ability to be able to tune out different distractions, but mainly these are cognitive. So mainly when I talk about inhibition, it's being able to stop certain types of behavior or actions. So
like, impulse control.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm really interested in if in musicians, if this ability to control distractibility, to stop and control distractibility as well as excessive movement, if there's an enhancement in that. Mm-hmm. And as we age, we become a little bit worse in those types of actions as well, and seeing whether musicians have this.
You mean they become older people have fewer inhibitions?
So it's mainly I wouldn't generalize.
Less impulse control.
I would say a little bit less in terms of distractibility and excessive movements. They have a harder time controlling and stopping excessive movements, okay. And then in terms of distractibility.
It seems strange. The trouble is to get old people to move. So.
And so if I'd step in a little bit about like motor inhibition, it's not necessarily keeping somebody from moving, but stopping inappropriate movements.
Sure.
So more like clumsiness or fine motor control. You want to make sure when you're picking something up that other parts that aren't supposed to move are inhibited. Otherwise, right. It could interfere. Okay. All right. And so those are the type of things that they see with aging is those other fine control of movements where you really shouldn't use your pinky kind of gets in the way and mm-hmm. that causes you to drop something or mishandle something.
Yeah,
that's the sort of
that.
Inhibition.
I was trained at one point as a yoga teacher, and that's one of the things that you don't make any unnecessary movements.
Exactly.
Yeah.
ADHD, and that's really my interest. And there hasn't been a lot of work done in terms of music training in ADHD, and it's a hard thing to do because it's not only getting participants, but also working with that specific population. So mm-hmm. in this case, it's, there would have to be, and that's a music therapist to be working with those, hopefully, either children or adults, depending. But it's just a more complex study. So it's really important to have a good foundation
sure.
of evidence before you pursue something like that.
The professor is now patting the student on the shoulder. She said the right thing there. Okay. Now, I don't know if this is the next natural progression, but how about music in elementary education?
Well, I'm a proponent, for sure. So I think one of the things that Patricia talked about was neuroplasticity. And so we can talk a little bit about how music helps the brain make new connections. And there's some, unique factors in music that aren't there with some other learning strategies or even other therapies. And so one of the most interesting things is that just listening to music that you enjoy increases dopamine. And dopamine is a neurotransmitter in the brain.
And associated with pleasure.
With pleasure, but also with learning. So a lot of times, once you get past the age of 3, you actually have to focus and pay attention in order to learn something.
You mean before 3 it's easier?
Yes, usually before 3 you kind of soak up the environment. If you uh-huh. think about little kids that right. somehow learn that bad word that you have no idea how they learned it. They probably heard it somewhere.
Well, especially if it's spoken with emotion.
Yes. So, but after that, the brain actually goes through a developmental change in which you actually need dopamine to be present in order to learn anything new and to make those new connections. So it's like a modulatory connection. So our modulatory transmitter. So the fact that music would increase that is kind of like increasing the chemicals or the neurotransmitters in your brain that you need to learn. So it can help with learning. We also know that to make new connections in the brain, neurons need to fire at the same time. And they call it the Hebbian principle that neurons that fire together wire together, or neurons out of sync do not link. That's my other favorite one. So the cool thing about music is the rhythm. So the
right.
rhythm does help synchronize.
Right, and rhyme does. You're using yep. rhyme there, too.
Firing in the
Since
brain.
Since I'm a literature person, I have to get that.
Yes. And so things like that actually help make connections in the brain. And so in order to learn stuff, new stuff, like Patricia was saying earlier, you need to make those connections in the brain. And so music has some really unique properties, dopamine and rhythm. And then the final one is that music is actually less noisy. And most people don't think too much about that, but our speech signals have more noise in it than a musical signal. So if you think about the harmonics of music, what makes it music is that the harmonics naturally line up, usually within intervals of each other. But with speech, there's a little bit more noise. And the brain...
Well, you seem to be using noise in a very specialized way there.
Right. So more...
I would say variability, possibly.
I guess variability. But if you look at the frequency spectrum, if you were to look at somebody, the frequency spectrum of someone speaking versus someone that's doing an ah sound or singing, there's less frequencies represented in a musical sound than in a speech sound.
Okay.
And so the more the frequencies that are represented, and if they're overlapping, that's in general in the speech world or in some of the more auditory world, it can be considered as noise.
Oh, confusing noise, you mean.
Yeah.
Confusing sounds. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think it's maybe if we think about what sound waves look like, it's kind of peaks and hills, and I think maybe the, you know, the music is just a cleaner.
It's a nice peak
version.
And a nice hill versus
sort of jaggedy.
Yes, jaggedy would be more speech.
Yeah,
like, and the brain does not like noise.
Okay, it doesn't like that jaggedy.
Yeah, it's harder for the brain to understand and encode noisy signals. So I always like to use like the cleanup song as an example of when you sing the cleanup song with kids. All this before, if you tell them clean up, they look at you like you're insane. You're like, I'm not going to clean this up, or they don't know what you mean. But as soon as you start singing clean up, clean up, it's almost like, oh, we're cleaning up now. And they automatically start cleaning up. Now, it could be because the music gets their attention, but it also could be that those words are conveyed in a less noisy signal than in, and that's easier. Yeah, or a bit of both. Mm-hmm. And it's easier for the brain to encode and understand, especially for the young brain.
Right.
So those are some three principles that I think in terms of music and music education are very important to keep in mind, and why we need music in our schools.
Right, and why maybe we need to educate people in general about this. Because, you know, I get a picture of little kids in school, you know, singing and marching around and doing things to music and having a good time. And sometimes people think, well, they're wasting their time. Why aren't they sitting there learning their letters? And but that's not a waste of time, is it?
No. If you think about it, how did we learn our letters?
Well, actually, I said I didn't learn them by marching around singing. Actually, I was No, I mean, you'd be horrified what it was like in elementary school when I was there.
And again, this is more anecdotal than anything, but you see so many really, you know, high-achieving professionals who are quote-unquote closet musicians. And I say that quote-unquote because some of them are just fantastic, you know, really great musicians. And, you know, we don't see those effects until someone is in their 20s, 30s plus. But I mean that again because they had that music training when they were younger. You know, it's, again, I think more anecdotal, but it should also support the fact that we need music in our schools.
Okay, we were talking about elementary education. How about prenatal? Is much known about that? You know, you hear a lot about when you're pregnant, you should play all sorts of music to your baby. And what have you got to say about that?
So I'll say a few things that have actually been possibly shown. So this is mainly work from the University of Helsinki, but what they found is newborn babies are able to discriminate sounds based off of their frequency, so not as complex sounds as we're able to process, but babies are aware of that happening. I'm not sure exactly how. I think they don't know either. But it's just that they were able to find things. Like this particular study found that babies that were exposed to or in utero to familiar melodies were able to recognize those melodies after
they were born.
But again, I think
They showed recognition by what, turning towards the sound or
usually.
Yep. And again, I always this is not my field of expertise, but it really, you have to be very careful how you have to be very good at understanding how babies behave. And I think that's a very big question mark as to whether or not they're actually responding to the music or something else. But again, I'm not an expert, but that's definitely a concern I always have is, are you able to accurately
interpret what the baby's doing?
Exactly.
And that was award-winning music researcher Patricia Izbicki and her major professor at Iowa State University, Dr. Elizabeth Stegemuller, speaking with KHOI reporter Kay Puttock. If you'd like to hear the entire interview, which covers many other important areas of Patricia's research, you can find it on KHOI's website, khoifm.org. It's called Neuroscience and Music and can be found on their homepage. And while you are at KHOI, go to khoifm.org. While you are there, make sure to make your member donation to keep KHOI on the air. You'll find the donate button right on the homepage. And join us in keeping community radio on the air. And this is Local Talk on KHOI. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today, together with Pat Schlarbaum. And the Ames Chamber of Commerce checks in with us monthly as well as underwriting KHOI regularly. Brenda Dreyer is here, Director of Ames Workforce Solutions. Brenda, tell us about the job fair coming up in Ames.
Well, we are pleased to be partnering with Iowa Works, which may be formally what people would know as Iowa Workforce Development or Job Service. But they have the office that serves this area is out of Des Moines. And September, we actually hosted a similar event, and it was really the first time in about 15 years that a job fair like this had actually been held in Story County. And so we weren't really sure what to expect. We held it at the library here in Ames, and they were a great host and very helpful to both the employers and the participants of the job fair. But in a 2-hour period, we saw more than 75 people actively looking for work, and we heard from the 19 employers that participated in the event how badly they wanted to continue having these career fairs here in Ames and Story County. And so we reacted to their interest and are pleased to actually be able to host another event before the end of 2017 on December 6th. And so that event will be held from 10 to noon at the Ames Public Library. And we have already almost exceeded the number of employers that were here in September. We have room for 21, and when I checked last week, we were at 19. So I'm very confident that we're going to have a very strong mix of employers that have current job openings. And in that 2-hour window, I'm hoping we see even more folks than we saw now that people have kind of been out and spread the word that the folks that are at the career fair actually have job openings. They're setting up interviews. I think it's not a large career fair, so it bodes well to being comfortable for people that maybe haven't went out and looked for a job before. But it was real successful in September, and so we're encouraging. We have room for a couple more employers. If they're interested in joining us, they can reach out to me at the chamber, and I'll get them connected to the right folks at Iowa Works. And more importantly, we're really hoping to get the word out to people and encourage them to come. We'll make sure we have free parking available. Again, it's a short commitment of time, and what a way to wrap up 2017 if you're either looking for work or looking to change employment. This is a nice event to start that process.
Brenda, I'm a person looking for employment, and I go to the job fair. What does it look like? What happens?
So, again, it's in one of the public rooms at the library that's not actually very accessible to the patrons that are at the library. It's, again, a large room, but yet small enough that it's not overwhelming. And we're encouraging people to be ready to talk to employers.
So bring your resume?
Bring your resume. Be ready to talk. Bring your calendar.
So is this kind of like speed dating? You sit down with an employer and you talk for
That's a great way, Ursula, to look at it. But, yeah. So
what do you do? You come, you sit down, and you talk for 10 minutes?
Or you meander around the room, and all of the employers have booths and displays, and it really is more of an informal nature, almost an introductory date situation.
So it's more like an opportunity to give your resume, not to actually have an interview.
Correct,
right there.
Correct. And, mm-hmm. and I know the employers that participated in September scheduled interviews, but it was a wonderful opportunity to drop off a resume. And, you know, I'm amazed. I spend a lot of time out in our employers, and we have great companies in service industries that call Ames and Story County home. And so I think sometimes people maybe don't realize the number of opportunities
and the benefits and the positions available.
So the jobs that are being offered at a fair like this, do they tend to be entry-level jobs or highly specialized? So, I mean, what kind of job are you looking for when you go there?
So as we we've been pretty thoughtful in the invitations that we've went out and really actively pursued employers. We have a number of our manufacturers that have full-time skilled and mid kind of skill level jobs. There's some entry level with them. Of course, our healthcare and human service area, they would be there. We also make sure that we have a couple employment agencies. So for some employers that may not know exactly what they really want to do, pursuing some opportunities through an employment agency is a great way to get started.
So it can be entry level as well as more skilled.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. So I think, again, so it's a nice variety. It's a short time commitment. The feedback we received both from the employers and the participants was it was something they wanted to continue to happen more often here in Story mm-hmm. County. They do similar job fairs in Polk County every month. I don't know that we need to do that, but I mm-hmm. think being on a more regular schedule so that people are aware that there is a chance mm-hmm. to meet with a number of employers in really a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And I always say, if you're not looking for work yourself, you know somebody that is looking for work. So I'm encouraging your listeners to help us get the word out that December 6th, 10 to noon, at the Ames Public Library. So, mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Talk to us just a little bit about the workforce situation, the employment situation in Ames, and how it compares to the rest of the state and the country.
Well, the unemployment rate for actually October will come out tomorrow for the individual counties in Iowa. We did receive notice late last week that the state of Iowa's unemployment was 3.4% in September, and it did drop pretty significantly in the month of October to 3%. I am not a skilled economist, but I would assume that is really related to the harvest mm-hmm. and work needed to whether it be at our elevators or on our farms, to actually do the harvest. So the formal explanation, I'm sure, will be out here in a week or so, but I would guess that's really what happened in the drop. But if you look at 2017 compared to 2018 in the state, I would say 80% of the state of Iowa is actually has lower unemployment than they had a year ago. And Story County is along those same lines. So in the month of September, we were at 2%. In a year ago, we were at 2.3%.
It's very low.
It is very low. And for years, I think actually in 2016, Story County's claim to fame was we actually had the lowest unemployment in the whole country. But interestingly enough, this whole last year or so, there's been two counties up in very, very far northwest Iowa, Lyon and Sioux County, that during the month of September, when we were at 2%, they were at 1.7. So I also think, so that's the low end of unemployment for the state of Iowa. I think it's interesting to note that we do continue to see high unemployment on the southeast side of the state. Lee County and Wapello County both are over 5%. And mm-hmm. so you think about, in the case of Lee County, they're almost 6%. So three times as high as what we have here in Story. So we are blessed that we do have a lot of our folks that want to work, are working. I think, like I said, the job fair in September was eye-opening to me. I didn't know what to expect. But when you have 75 folks in a very tight labor market show up to work, you either have folks that are underemployed, so they have skills that they're not using. Maybe they're not working a 40-hour work week. So while we have low unemployment, I think we have a real strong underemployment situation that we need to be considering.
Okay. Thank you, Brenda. Brenda Dreyer is with the Ames Chamber of Commerce, Director of Workforce Solutions. Is there a website that folks can go to find out about this?
You know, you can contact our offices, but I always direct people to workinames.com. We have over 1,500 job openings. We continue to have that high level, and we'd love to have people take advantage.
Thank you. This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with
Pat Schlarbaum.
Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio. Mm-hmm.